truly are, and at the same time loving you with his full heart. So it's good and it's not good. It's both. Some people like you would love to know more about people's bad attitude, about people's past, whatever they have done.
I just want to know if somebody's going to harm me or my family or the people I care about.
You
That's
would
all.
Get that.
No, not always. Sometimes you have people who are very close to you and they sting the most, right? And you don't know that until they sting.
Oh, what do you say if I tell you that? You knew it from the very first point, but you just did not believe in it because you love that person. Because that person is too close
to
you.
Yeah, I agree. But so, it was still enough doubt to give you a plausible reason to deny it. You see, so if that doubt wasn't there, it's like you're already saying you already have this intuitive feeling about somebody and you know that that person's, you know, dodgy. If only we had enough conviction to follow that, because that would save us from so many issues in life. You have a new boss at work, for example, and you have this feeling that they're manipulative. But you go ahead with it because the job is so great and stuff, and you do the job, and then you realize that, oh, this is...
But I would be cautious still. I'd be cautious about everything.
Yeah. I think, maybe.
So that's helping me already. That intuitive thing would help me.
You're saying it's enough. You don't need to know more.
Yeah, that's enough. That's enough. I don't need to know more about human beings. I already know that human beings could go to different extreme of badness. But then I don't have to necessarily know that. This is going to be enough of initiation to know that somebody is capable of doing dangerous stuff. And I would still be cautious about those people. So this was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you, brother. And thank you, dear listeners. Until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif.
Hola, soy Daniel Jadwe.
I am Daniel Jadwe, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine, born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora. Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, history, and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine.
Hola a todos y a todas. Marhaba.
Hello everyone, marhaba. The Palestinians do not own Palestine. They have belonged to that land for thousands of years. They have been there since before the first invader arrived, and they will surely be there in the same place when the last one leaves. In more than 3,000 years of history, there have only been about 200 years of true peace in Palestine. And Palestine, because of its geopolitical and geostrategical significance, has always been the center of a dispute for world hegemonies. This land creates connections between Africa, Asia, and Europe.
Al ser el punto de contacto entre África, Asia y Europa.
The terrorism that Palestine suffers today is undoubtedly endorsed by the international community, which has completely failed in the objectives of maintaining peace and avoiding a new genocide.
Como dice el secretario general
As the Secretary General of the United Nations says, what is happening today in Palestine is unprecedented, not only during his mandate, but throughout the entire history of the UN. The international community has completely failed, and international law, both human rights and international humanitarian law, have simply become a resounding ridicule in the face of the thousands of lives that are being slaughtered today. They are facing genocide by Israel's policy of political and physical extermination of the Palestinian people. Let's take a look at this report by journalist Huda Eghazi, who will give us more information about this absolute failure of the international community.
The UN General Assembly has called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Palestinian territory of the Gaza Strip. The gesture takes place while, due to the United States veto, the Security Council has not adopted any resolution in favor of truce. The text of the General Assembly resolution has enjoyed the support of the overwhelming majority of the international community.
The United States is deciding the course of the lives of all Gazans when it uses its veto power. Therefore, it is complicit in the crimes that Israel is committing against the people of the Gaza Strip, using the veto to reject the call for a ceasefire, which is asked by almost all of the world countries, means condemning an entire people in general.
Despite the ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people that began on October 7, 2023, and the murder of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, the Security Council has failed to adopt a resolution calling for a ceasefire. Many countries and human rights organizations have lamented the failure of this entity.
All decisions that have been made by the UN Security Council and the United Nations are under the direct influence of the United States, since Washington has the final say. No one can make any decision without being approved by the United States, since it controls the entity. Many states in the international community support Israel, except for a few like the Islamic Republic of Iran, Venezuela, and etc. But in general, many states, including Arab ones, support Israel. The Arab states of the Persian Gulf also support Israel.
It seems that Israel is not satisfied with the demolition of Gaza homes, infrastructure, and killing of civilians. Images have recently emerged of Palestinians being detained by the occupation army, being forced to strip to their underwear, kneeling on the ground, blindfolded, and held in inhumane conditions. These images have provoked outrage among civil society in different corners of the world.
The Israel army does not differentiate between children, civilians, and the elderly, especially in the northern area of Gaza. They enter any place they want and arrest whoever they want, even arresting children under 15 years of age without any fault, even committing violent acts against them. This is a criminal act. There is no country in the world that has done what the regime of Israel has committed. Look what happened between Russia and Ukraine. Everyone came out in protest to stop the war. The war that Israel is waging against Gaza is more criminal than what the Nazis did in Germany. What Israel does is a crime, and it is not justifiable.
No es justificable.
The Hamas resistance movement accused Israel in a statement of kidnapping and murdering innocent civilians, describing it as a reprehensible crime, and insisted on human rights organizations to intervene. Despite all the crimes that Israel is committing against the civilian population in the Gaza Strip, the international community, especially the West, continues to fail to react to this ongoing genocide. This shows how the United States, the main sponsor of Tel Aviv, has become complicit in atrocities against the nation. Huda Eghazi, Gaza, Palestine.
Sin duda que las víctimas del Holocausto nazi
No doubt, the victim of the Nazi Holocaust would roll in their graves if they could see what their descendants are capable of doing to the Palestinian people today. We thank Huda for this interesting report and greet Jorge Ramos Tolosa, PhD in history, a professor specialized in the contemporary and recent history of Palestine at the University of Germany. Thank you, Jorge, for being with us. A hug and welcome. I want to ask you two questions that everyone should be asking. Zionism has said time and again that Palestine belongs to them. You could first tell us who lived in Palestine before the creation of the regime of Israel and what role the Western powers played in the creation of Israel.
En la creación del Estado de Israel en la tierra de los palestinos?
Sí, claro. Bueno, lo primero, muchísimas gracias por invitarme. Es un...
Yes, of course. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me. It is a pleasure to be here with you. I think it is a fundamental question, Daniel, to address any issue related to Palestine. I think it is essential to understand that for more than a millennium, for more than 1,000 years, Palestine has been a very diverse territory in which Jewish people, Christian people, Muslim people, people from other minorities of any kind have lived following their own religions. And it all begins not 2,000 years ago. The question of Palestine does not go back to 2,000 years. It is not a religious issue, although we are talking about the Holy Land, obviously, and there are different actors who use religion as a legitimizing element and as a mobilizing element. And Zionism itself, although in the beginning the majority of Zionists did not believe in God, and yet they did believe that God has given them the earth. So this is essential. We're talking about a colonial issue, specifically settler colonialism that began at the end of the 19th century when this Zionist movement, which did not represent Judaism, nor was it a branch of Judaism. Neither Zionism nor the regime of Israel represent Judaism, nor are they branches of Judaism, but they do speak in its name. But it has precisely become a Zionist movement. And if we review contemporary Jewish history, we see that there have been and currently exist numerous people and numerous Jewish groups that are clearly anti-Zionist, both from religious Jewish identities and from cultural Jewish identities or by family heritage. So of course in Palestine, as they say, when Zionism emerged at the end of the 19th century, there were no problems between the Jewish, Christian and Muslim communities. By the way, they all spoke Arabic. They were all Arabs. It is a criterion above all linguistic cultural criteria. And they lived together in a territory that belonged to the Ottoman Empire. And of course, it was the arrival of a European settlement colonialism movement that drew on European Judeophobic racism and that basically accepted the racist anti-Jewish idea that Jewish people could not live in Europe, which triggered the colonialization of Palestine. The problems created by these hegemonies we are seeing to this day. And of course, this Zionist movement had at its center and continues to have at its center the regime of Israel, obtaining the maximum possible territory with a minimum native population, with a minimum non-Jewish population. So of course, how to achieve this? This is a question. At the end of the 19th century, there were 85 to 86% of the Palestinian population that was Muslim, 10 to 11% of the population that was Christian, and less than 5% that were Jewish. Now, how can one accept that a territory with less than 5% Jewish demographic becomes exclusively or mostly Jewish, as Zionism intended? Of course, history is never written, nor is it linear, but obviously, this Zionist objective could hardly be achieved without massively expelling or discriminating and segregating the native Palestinian population. We call this apartheid. Then in 1948, the regime of Israel was created. The Zionist movement had a fundamental triumph, but its objective of expanding over the maximum possible territory with the minimum Palestinian population did not end there. But 75 years later, it is still continues and it is still underway.
We're going to have the audience ask you two questions so that we can also answer the doubts they have. Who would like to ask Jorge? Please.
Hola. Mi nombre es Dante Olate.
Hello, my name is Dante Olate. I'm a student, and I wanted to ask what the Sykes-Picot Agreement is, what this treaty consists of, and how it affected the fate of Palestine.
¿Y cómo afectó el destino de Palestina?
Muy bien. Muchas gracias por tu pregunta, Dante.
Very good. Thank you very much for your question, Dante. Of course, it is essential to understand that the Zionist movement began the colonization of Palestine at the end of the 19th century, when Palestine was an undifferentiated entity that was part of the Ottoman Sultanate. And one of its main purposes was to gain the support of a great power, because, of course, it was a movement of settler colonialism. The Zionist movement was not directed solely by a state, nor was it a company of a state, as was the case with the British East India Company or the Dutch. So it was essential to get the support of a great power. So in the context of the First World War, where the Sykes-Picot Agreement that you mentioned happened, we must take into account that the United Kingdom was the most important imperial power of the time. Following the outbreak of the First World War, one of its enemies was the Ottoman Sultanate. With regard to the strategic position that Palestine had in the Eastern Mediterranean, almost at a crossroads between Africa, Asia, and Europe, it could be the ideal place for creating an ally for future, a puppet state, or a geopolitical platform that served their interests or was linked to their interests. Then, of course, here also the second great imperial power of the time, which was France, was interested in the fact that if the Ottoman Sultan was defeated, it could gain some profits from the remains of the numerous territories of the Ottoman Sultanate. France and the United Kingdom were seeking territorial advantages and acquiring those territories, and in fact, they were thinking how to manage to colonize those territories after the Ottoman Sultanate was defeated. And so it happened. Secretly, in the spring of 1916, Mark Sykes and Francois Georges Picot, British and French delegates respectively, signed secret agreements, the Sykes-Picot Agreements, by which they divided a large part of the territory of the Ottoman Sultanate, and it finally happened. In case the Ottoman Sultanate lost the First World War, the disintegration and end of this empire was forced. So it is essential to understand that these agreements, which were, by the way, revealed by the Bolshevik revolutionary forces in November 1917, a little more than a year after their signing and a few weeks after the revolution of October 1917, of course, these agreements were fundamental for future. The distribution of the map of the Eastern Mediterranean of Southwest Asia, this is essential. And furthermore, they were hand in hand with the famous Balfour Declaration. In the Balfour Declaration of November 1917, what Zionism had been seeking for long happened for the first time. For the first time, the United Kingdom stated in a letter that it was going to support the creation of a Jewish national home, which everyone understood to be a state that the Zionist movement sought. And then, although there were ambiguous and ambivalent formulas, effectively, this declaration came while the British troops arrived in Palestine, and stayed there with the aim of incorporating Palestine into the British Empire in the following years. The British forces, which were in Palestine since 1917, after the British mandate of Palestine became effective, they abandoned Palestine in 1948, and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the creation of the State of Israel began. At this time, the United Kingdom fully supported the Zionist movement. And in fact, we still see many borders in the Eastern Mediterranean and Southwest Asia that correspond to this era, right? The United Kingdom was left with the administration of Palestine and Jordan, Iraq and France, with Syria and Lebanon, and they were British and French colonies, respectively, for several decades until they achieved their independence. But the case of Palestine is special. It has been different and continues to be different precisely because of this movement of colonialism. The United Kingdom was the only settlement that was already there from previous decades, which was Zionism and achieved the creation of the regime of Israel through ethnic cleansing in 1948.
Muchas gracias, Jorge, por...
Thank you very much, Jorge, for your presence on our program. I give you a hug from here, and I hope to be able to contact you again in the future. Thank you so much.
De aquí en el futuro. Muchas gracias.
Also a pleasure. Thank you very much to you.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back.
Bueno, ya estamos de vuelta y queremos hablar...
Well, we are back, and we want to talk about another one of the main victims of this historic Palestinian aggression. We're going to talk about culture, and for that, we have invited Andrea Giadach, Chilean actress, playwright, theater director of Palestinian origin, but also someone who has worked for a long time in the field of culture, fundamentally rescuing traditions, reconstructing her own identity.
Andrea Giadach is a playwright, director, actress, and member of the Artists for Palestine NGO. Her works are recognized everywhere and among her peers. She has worked on topics such as the loss of the homeland, identity, and reconstruction, among others. As the granddaughter of Palestinian migrants, her story and her vocation have been crossed by the diaspora and by the link with artistic communities in the occupied territories of Palestine. One of her most notable works is Mi Mundo Patria, which is scenic heritage. Together with Alejandra Diaz, an actress of Jewish origin, they founded the Natuf Collective, made of Chileans of Palestine and Jewish origin, and whose main work is El Circulo, which seeks to remove views regarding antagonists and the possibility of relating honestly without denialism and trying to see the other reality.
Hi, Andrea. How are you? Thank you very much for coming and for accepting this invitation. I always start by asking, when and why did your family arrive in Chile?
Well, thanks, Daniel, for the invitation. Indeed, my family arrived at the beginning of the 20th century because of the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, who were in the entire Levant area as well. We were in Palestine when Palestine was still Palestine, because there was a multicultural space there. They took the Christians as soldiers and used them as cannon fodder. So many Palestinians at that time came to Chile and formed a large community, among them my grandfather. That's how they arrived here, more or less. I could go on, but we can talk about so many things today.
Oh, no, it's okay. Well, this actually was because of a change that occurred in 1898 on the part of the Turkish Sultan, because with the emergence of national states and the loss of the religious character of the Empire of States, the prohibition on both Jews and Christians was lifted to participate in the war defending the empire against the West. And when this happens, they actually begin to take everyone to the army, especially the firstborn, Jews and Christians, and that is why there was a very strong immigration from this entire area, and that defines their diaspora in Chile and throughout the world of a great Christian community. In Latin America, the countries that have this Christian community are fundamentally Honduras, El Salvador, and Chile, which is where the Palestinians of that group have settled. Now, you are third generation, aren't you?
Yes, I am the third generation.
Did your parents always raise you as a Palestinian?
¿Cómo Palestina?
Mi padre, sobre todo, me crió como Palestina.
My father, above all, raised me as a Palestinian, but more than as a Palestinian, under the consciousness of a Palestinian-ness. And I also believe that he is to blame for me being a Palestinian activist, because I am not aware of when I started to become active, given my father always taught me about and showed me Zionist and anti-Arab propaganda. Since I was little, he showed me the movies, how the Arabs were portrayed as the bad guys among other people, among the Russians, etc. But well, he always made me very alert in relation to media propaganda and how the media continues to this day, right? We can see it. They are absolutely taken over by Zionism.
Hasta el día de hoy, ¿verdad? Lo podemos ver, están tomados absolutamente por el sionismo.
A ver, yo tengo un poco una respuesta,
Let's see. I kind of have an answer that you just said you don't have. I'll try it. Because you say, I don't really know when I became an activist, and I feel that you become an activist when you find your place in the world. You found your place in the world of theater, in the world of theatrical creation, true? And I remember since we knew each other, which are many more years than we would like to admit to, right? From your first steps after leaving theater school, you started creating theater around Palestine. I remember very well the first work I saw of your own creation. It was Mi Mundo Patria, right? Which told the story of Fadda Wabe, a Palestinian immigrant, and from then on, I remind you, always linked to theatrical creation around Palestine first, and around the recovery of peaceful coexistence later. Tell us a little bit about that.
Cuéntanos un poco de aquello.
Sí, bueno, efectivamente, Mi Mundo Patria...
Yes, well, indeed, Mi Mundo Patria, my homeland, as you say, makes me an activist. But Mi Mundo Patria also makes me a director and playwright. And that is because of a deep need that Lorena Ramirez Alamo had. She was my partner with whom we made this creation. And of course, my own need, a common need, to make known the reality of Palestine. Since I was little, since I was in school, I talked about Palestine, and they seemed to look at you as if you're against the Jews and poor Jews who were in the Holocaust. That was the story only. I say, well, how should we talk about Palestine in a way that we can really attract people? So what I did was take certain relevant episodes, which is the loss of homeland and childhood in three people of different nationalities, origins, or identities. And among those people was Fouad Dawawi. I took testimony, Dramaturgy Network, and that is the result of my homeland, which was incredible. It took place for years, and it is scenic heritage today.
We're still giving it. In fact, we saw it recently, right?
Yes, yes. And then I take on the challenge of creating a work from the antagonistic look. What's that? We met Chilean Jews and Palestinians. I proposed to them, well, the only thing I can propose here is that we go as far as we can. And I invite you to generate or establish a dialogue to see how far we can turn our look. We can see others in that way. We're always talking about hegemonic stories and other stories, macro stories, right? But we had micro stories based on a question, which was, to what extent do we generate otherness for fear of rejection from the community itself? The result was incredible. We presented this worm for many times, and recently we had a circulation in three regions of Chile in the south. And not only were the Jews and the Palestinians affected by this work, but many Chilean people said, this work is very necessary because we are increasingly polarized. Of course, the Palestinian reality is so absolute that it always goes on, and if there is someone who dares to look, there is no turning back.
Andrea, I want to thank you for this interesting interview, and of course, we are going to continue seeing each other. I will undoubtedly be in this new work that you are preparing. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. See you in the next chapter.
Muchas gracias. Nos vemos en el próximo capítulo.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has suffered a number of defeats in the House of Lords over his controversial bill to rescue the stalled Rwanda plan. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Civil servants have threatened ministers with legal action over concerns that senior Home Office staff could be in breach of international law if they implement the government's Rwanda deportation bill. The FDA union, which represents senior civil servants, have warned that they could also be in violation of the Civil Service Code and open to possible prosecution if they follow the minister's demands to ignore an urgent injunction from Strasbourg banning a deportation. It has sent a pre-action legal letter to James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, calling for clarity, with a request to either amend the legislation or change the code. The Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill states that it is for ministers to decide whether to comply with decisions by the European Court of Human Rights to temporarily halt a deportation. The letter said, "The concern of the FDA union and many of its members is that if ministers instruct civil servants not to comply with an interim measure indication, they will be putting the United Kingdom in breach of international law." With the bill due to return to the House of Commons in the coming days and the government expected to try to get the first flights off the ground within days of that, the FDA union warned that it may require legal proceedings to clarify the matter. People who have been refused asylum could reportedly be offered thousands of pounds to move to Rwanda under a new voluntary scheme. According to the Times newspaper, the proposals, which are separate from the main scheme and are understood to have been agreed with Kigali, are designed to remove people who have no legal right to stay in the United Kingdom but cannot be returned to their home country. It will be aimed at individuals who do not have an outstanding asylum claim and are in a position to be relocated swiftly. An intervention by a Strasbourg judge last June stopped the only attempted deportation flight from taking off for Rwanda. Dave Penman, the FDA's general secretary, said in his letter that the government had acknowledged there was a problem and planned to issue draft guidance to make it clear that it was the responsibility of civil servants to implement the decisions of ministers. Sir Matthew Ryecroft, the Home Office's top civil servant, said in a letter dated 17th of January, "Given the nature of removal flights, officials should be available to advise ministers at short notice and during the evenings and weekends. Home Office officials shall proceed with removal if the relevant minister approves that course of action." But Dave Penman said that while the FDA union welcomed the government's recognition of the need to clarify civil servants' responsibilities, it did not consider the guidance to be adequate. He cited advice from the Attorney General, revealed recently that it was beyond doubt that interim measures from the court to stop a deportation were binding for the United Kingdom under international law, and that there was no respectable argument to the contrary. The letter goes on to say that difficulty arises because civil servants have personal legal obligations under domestic law not to act contrary to international law. That obligation is not capable of being overwritten by any ministerial instruction or guidance. The Civil Service Code states that officials must comply with the law, which the government has previously confirmed includes international law, meaning that any ministerial instruction to ignore a Strasbourg ruling would be a breach of their terms of service. The letter adds, Ministers do not employ civil servants and cannot unilaterally change or alter their terms of service. The guidance is erroneous in law and gives serious uncertainty for civil servants and would foreseeably place them in an exceptionally difficult position. The FDA union warned that given the implementation of new Rwanda bill in coming weeks, its letter was acting as a pre-action notification of a potential claim for judicial review in the event of ministers instructing officials to ignore a Strasbourg injunction. A government spokesperson said matters of international law are rightly a matter for ministers in the event that the ministers decides, in the light of full policy, operational and legal advice, not to comply with a Rule 39 indication in an individual case, it is the responsibility of civil servants operating under the Civil Service Code to implement that decision. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has suffered a number of defeats in the House of Lords over his controversial bill to rescue the stalled Rwanda plan. House of Lords peers have voted through five amendments which, if enacted in law, would make it harder for Parliament to declare the African nation safe and would require the government to comply with domestic and international laws. This would effectively kill the central purpose of the legislation, which aims to prevent further legal challenges against the policy after it was ruled unlawful by Britain's Supreme Court. The votes don't scupper the bill entirely, but set into motion the process of parliamentary ping-pong between the House of Lords and the House of Commons until an agreement is reached. As well as compelling judges to regard Rwanda as safe, Rishi Sunak's Safety of Rwanda Bill is designed to give ministers the power to disregard key sections of the UK's Human Rights Act and other international rules that stand in the way of deportations. Peers from across the political spectrum have criticised it because they believe it breaks international law. On Monday, 4th of March, the upper chamber backed a move to ensure the legislation is fully compliant with the law by 274 votes to 172, a majority of 102. The House of Lords also backed by 282 to 180, another majority of 102, a demand that Parliament cannot declare Rwanda safe until the treaty it signed with the country in December is fully implemented. The treaty aims to address the issues raised by the Supreme Court in November and includes provisions to stop asylum seekers who end up in Rwanda being sent back to their country of origin. In a third defeat for the government, peers voted by 277 votes to 167, a majority of 110, in favour of establishing a monitoring mechanism able to check whether Rwanda is safe. Two other amendments were passed which called for the presumption that Rwanda is safe to be open to challenge in the courts of law if credible evidence emerges. Lord Anderson of Ipswich, an independent crossbencher and lawyer, said, "If Rwanda is safe, as the government would have us believe, it has nothing to fear from such scrutiny." Several Conservative peers also voted against the government's position, including former Tory Chancellor Kenneth Clark. Ken Clark warned that if the bill is ultimately passed by Parliament, it will likely face another challenge in the Supreme Court.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing. I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and teenagers, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed light on this important subject. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. We had begun talking about one of the questions, which was, what role does religion of Islam play in shaping the personality of our youth today? And you said that you were, you know, describing what personality is and how we're all so unique, and that the teenage time and the youth time is the right time to shape the personality, and that's why Islam has a lot of things to say about that.
That's right, absolutely. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I want to point out some ahadith that gives the superiority of this age range that is the Holy Prophet has emphasized so much, that this is the ripe age and the right age to form the personality. And he says that make the most of your youth before you become old. That's the Holy Prophet's ahadith. And then also another hadith of the Holy Prophet, that tradition of the Holy Prophet, that says, addressing teachers and parents, that I recommend that you treat adolescents and young adults, that is, he means the teenagers, of course, treat them well, because they have a tender heart and that absorbs virtues. It absorbs virtues. If you go and see, I myself, when I look back at when I was young, it becomes so like a kind of an influence that is not there now. You get so much influence by good.
Yeah.
You feel so much more motivation when you want to do a good, when you see somebody doing a good, or when it has influenced you. And you feel like you want to, you know, get it part and parcel of yourself.
True. I feel like when I just went to Rahian and Nuran, I can really relate to what you're just saying. You just feel like, this is how I want to be, this is who I would like to be like. And
there's a certain kind of energy and excitement that you get at that time. And that fades away. So I'm of course praying that it never fades away, because this is not what Islam teaches us. Islam says, be hopeful to the end. But this is the best time that to inculcate these kind of values. Another tradition very interesting about personality and how it can affect the age of adolescence is that the Holy Prophet has said, Allah has appointed me as a prophet to give people glad tidings of the divine mercy and warn them of his punishment. Youths accepted my word and entered into a covenant of affection with me, but the elderly refused to accept my call and opposed me. So youths were the first one to be driven towards him.
Yeah.
Like a youth, that is Imam Ali alayhi salam. He was the first one who was just about 10 years old, or you can say 11 years old. But he was the first one to say that, I am there to help you. I am the one to help you, three times in Da'watul Ashira,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And the Prophet still gave people chances, you know, that who is there. But he was still the first one to come forward.
Sorry, before we continue, we'll just take a quick break and we'll pick up shortly from that.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Coming
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we were discussing about what role the religion of Islam has to play in shaping the personality of our youth. And you were just telling us something about
some of the traditions that talk about how important the youth age is. Again, the Holy Prophet mentions in one of the traditions that the devout young person is as superior to the devout old person as the prophets are to other people. So young person who is devout and religious and, you know, like a good follower of religion, devotee, you know, worshipper, things like that, acceptor of religion, is better than the devout old person.
True.
As the prophets are superior to the people. It's so amazing, yeah?
Yeah. And I think that is why what the media is doing right now is that they're trying to, you know, impact the youth so much, bombard them so much with so many of these ideologies and, you know, dirty thoughts and everything, because they know this is that prime time where they're going to, you know, sip in everything.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
And that is so unfortunate, because that is also that prime time where you can get closest to Allah.
Yeah.
You know, so it's how you...
In fact, everywhere in the world, if you go and see, if they want to influence, they see the youth.
Yeah.
If they want to misguide somebody, they'll go for the youth. If they want to point into a new idea, they'll go for the youth. If they want to recruit labor, they'll go for the youth. You know, youth is that prime time, as you say. Then Imam Ja'far Sadiq al-Islam also has a tradition about youth and young people, is that he says, young people's hearts are more tender than those of the elderly. Like, also we see other philosophers like Socrates was asked, why do you associate with young people most? So he replied, the twigs can be set right, but the hard woods that are not fresh are inflexible.
Mm.
So whatever, you know, your personality is, when it's formed, your habits are formed, your pattern, life pattern is formed, you're habituated to a certain character, then you can't go away from that character so easily.
Yeah.
As the youths, which are still flexible, they
it's
can still...
True.
Yeah. Young people can be influenced easily. Therefore, all those who work for either rectification or corruption of a society pay careful attention to them. So whole society, you know, they want to, if they want to rectify or corrupt it, they pay attention to the youth more.
That's why they go on saying that the youth are our future, our tomorrow, because they are the ones kind of holding this whole, like, the community together. This,
yeah.
It's very important, like, yeah.
Now we come to religion. What role does it play to shape the personality? It plays a fundamental role, of course, in shaping the personality of a young person. And many questions that are left unanswered, only religion can answer them. Islam is such a complete religion that only you get the best answers from Islam.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, like, kind of acknowledges this point, you know. Whether they like it or not, whether they are truly Islamic believers or not, but they will clarify. For example, if you go and see, an example we can give is George Jordak of reading Nahjul Balagha.
Yeah.
He read it how many times? Something like 100 and something times or 200 and something times.
Wow.
Yeah. So we might have finished it 2-3 times, but he read it and read it. Of course, he was after that literary aspect more.
Yeah.
To it than that teachings that he got. But he was so moved and he didn't understand some parts, so he kept on repeating. So what of us who might have not read it even probably once completely? So this encourages us that if a person like George Jordak, who, you know, wasn't even a Muslim, but he was so much influenced because there were so many answers that he could get from. But he didn't want to, of course, you know, come up to that. Maybe he was in an age that wasn't so flexible.
Very true.
But you found so many answers to the questions.
And I feel like the youths, it's Allah has kept it in our innate nature that we are, you know, drawn to goodness, we're drawn to good things.
Yeah.
But because of the way the world has been created, like the world has been made, that, you know, youths should waste their time more, they should go and, you know, do useless things. And this is really pulling them away from the goodness that they can achieve. And that is that, like you said, like we were saying, the prime time. And I feel it's so unfortunate, like, that is what's happening right now. Total bombardment on the youth's ideologies, and therefore they're growing up with, you know, this kind of tainted thoughts, and it's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
So we're just going to take a quick break and we'll pick up from this.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we were just discussing about what Islam's role is in shaping the personality of our youth. And Sister Salma, you said very many important things from the hadith, especially that, you know, they have youth have a more tender heart, they're first to accept things, they can be influenced easily, and Islam is the thing that really comes and gives you all the answers.
That's right, absolutely. So all the questions, if you go and see, that are disturbing the youth, only Islam can answer. And for the young people who have turned away from religion, they don't have religion, life becomes meaningless, you know.
Yeah.
And when this happens, when life becomes meaningless for them, they don't set goals for themselves.
Mm.
And then if they don't set goals for themselves, they don't feel a sense of achievement.
Yeah.
And then what happens is amusement and play, lahw and laib, takes over. And this becomes tiring for their mind as an adult. An adult can't endure always, you know, like lahw and laib. He needs intellection.
True,
he needs to think. He needs a goal. He needs a sense of achievement. He wants more. So no set of manners and virtues outside religion. Religion plays this role. It gives a set of manners and virtues so that goal is set. So here, if that religion is not there as an important factor in one's life, a youth's life, there are no set of manners and virtues to adhere to. Only what happens? Whims and desires take over.
Yeah.
The nafs takes over.
Yeah.
And you know, in the Quran, there's an ayat for Alhamaha fujuraha wa taqwaha. Both are there in an equal level. You can have the ilham of fujur and taqwa also. Goodness and badnesses. So here there's no goodness, right? It's empty. So badness overtakes. Whims and desires, and his whole humanity is spoilt. You know, it's wasted, you can say. Then bad habits are formed. Individuality is lost. You know, personality fades. It becomes a very poor personality. It's not a man of personality. It's not a boy of personality. It's not a girl of personality. Mostly you use personality when you want to use something good about a person, yeah? That he's a man or a boy of personality. What a great personality he has.
Yeah.
You can't say he has a bad personality.
Like, what are they looking up to right now? I feel like the youth, because they don't have any good people to look up to, people with good personalities, that is why they feel like, yeah, this is how life is. I mean, look at who they're looking up at. They're looking up at models and actresses and actors and, okay, footballers. So they, some aspects, maybe you'd say, okay, the sports aspect is good, but what else are they looking up to? And when they see that they don't have anything of substance, that's when they realize, okay, what life is pointless. Or when they look up at these actresses and all, and they see, oh, this actress, she's so kind, like something simple as kindness, then they, you know, put it out there that, oh, this one is you, the person you should follow. When we have role models with all kinds of perfections to look up at too.
Religion is only the one that provides that, those role models, right? We have the extremely beautiful, perfect role models. And that's why religion is the only way to shape the personality. It gives that those perfect role models that, you know, youths have a thirst to follow someone. At the time of youth, you know, this age is such that a person wants to follow someone.
Definitely.
So someone they can relate to.
Yeah.
So a human being needs a human being, right? So they'll be a more strict follower of those kind of, you know, like role models that are perfect in their personalities.
Very true, very true. So that was very, very insightful. And thank you very much for your valuable time, Sister Selma. And we hope to see you in the next episode. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. You've just listened to IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. And if you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI. Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.